Tonight on The Download, the writer and director of the film Love Jones, Theodore Witcher, Tribune Inc. columnist Tracy Swartz, and we reload this week's news with Nyla Boodoo and Craig Newman. And now, here's your host, a man who wanted to be a slam poet until he realized he couldn't rhyme, Justin Kaufman.
So it's just this thing with my head every time I'm like, I'm here to save the day. I'm going to go and sleep. I can't. I'm the reluctant poet. It's a series we've got going on here. Hey, everybody, Justin Kaufman. It's a download with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on WGN Radio. Wow, what a night for news, and we're going to reload this week's news. There's so much that's happened this week. You know, it being Friday, we reload the news. Nyla Boodoo and Craig Newman both in studio tonight to help with the biggest stories, the winners, the losers, the overreported, the underreported, stories that took us down the rabbit hole, stories that'll be remembered in 50 years from now. But that's all great. It's been a great week. But we could reload tonight's news with all the stories that are popping. I mean, the old adage of, oh, you know, this concept that, you know, people like to drop news at the end of the day on Fridays so they don't actually deal with the media after asking them questions, or more people are on their way. Like a lot of people right here in the Chicago area this weekend, they're right now on 94. They're going up to Michigan. They're in Wisconsin. They're done with the news. They're just done with it. Got the music on, maybe listening to The Download because they want to hear about Love Jones, all that. Last thing they want is all of the news that's coming out. So let's just start from the top. Just breaking right now on Twitter that the White House has announced that President Trump has pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the sheriff from Arizona, who was controversial and was being held in a criminal contempt of court charge because he was racially profiling. He was pulling over people of Latino descent to make sure that they were documented. That's the exact opposite of the constitutional rights that we've set up in this country. And a judge said that, and he continued to do it, and he was thrown in jail on contempt. The president of the United States kind of joked about it when he was in Arizona that he was going to pardon. And tonight, right before the end of business hours, even after, Friday night, he does it. He pardons Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Wow. What a turn of events when the White House earlier in the week said he wasn't going to do it. Someone called it out saying he wasn't going to do it that night. It was a good little, they parsing words. So you got that. We've been reporting here on WGN that in Texas, the hurricane that has forced an evacuation of Corpus Christi has gone from a Category 3 to a Category 4 as it gets ready to hit land. It's a huge deal to move from a 3 to 4 going right through populated areas of Texas. That is not going to be a good situation. All eyes and prayers and thoughts and the people of Texas, South Texas, as they evacuate and flee. And there are evacuation orders and all sorts of alarms that are going off. Say, get out of Corpus Christi. It's not a good situation, but a developing story, a natural disaster story, also happening on Friday night. Locally, you have Governor Rauner right at the end of the day vetoing the 15-hour minimum wage bill. He decides that that is not good for the state of Illinois. It's something that in Chicago they've already done. They've moved it forward in many other municipalities. This was a state move. It's not, Illinois is not an outlier. Governor Rauner, which I want to say, you know, maybe it was unexpected, but really, but, you know, it is a political issue. But the governor out of nowhere vetoes that bill right in the midst of a school funding negotiation. $15 an hour minimum wage is a big Democrat issue. And how is that going to play out? And we'll talk. I mean, there's so much. And then the president signed the order this afternoon to put into play the banning of transgendered military. New recruits as well. People that were in the pipeline, they're out. This all happened within the last hour and a half. It's crazy to think about all the news that's happening in right now. And then I didn't even mention North Korea. Jeez, as I'm saying, we don't even, I mean, I've done biggest, overreported, underreported. I've done it all right now, just in the last hour. North Korea shooting off short-range ballistic missiles into the ocean. They went 155, 160 miles. But this is not a good story, because there was thought that the diplomacy was working from South Korea and the United States, Secretary of State, talking about that they were going to ratchet that down for fear of provocation, as they discussed. And then out of nowhere on a Friday night, North Korea's like, nah, let's ratchet it back up. I'm annoyed that I'm not in. I'm annoyed this sheriff from Arizona is getting all the headlines. Kim Jong-un's like, no, I want him back. So amazing after evening for news here in our country and the world. Amazing. We'll talk all about it. I'm glad we're having Nyla Boodoo and Craig Newman in studio. Like I said, we've already kind of, today we've gone back and forth on email to say what were the big stories. The clips was this week. I mean, there's so many great big stories, but the idea that we could pretty much talk about just what happened tonight. We will do that coming up at 8 o'clock tonight. At 7:30, Theodore Witcher's going to join us. He is the writer and director of the film Love Jones. Love Jones, a great romantic, it's not a comedy, drama, starring Nia Long and Lorenz Tate. Kate was shot here in Chicago by a Chicagoan, all about the Chicago slam poetry scene. It's a great movie, and a lot of people out there listening right now have seen it. It's celebrating its 20th anniversary. Isn't it hard to believe it was shot? It was put out in 1997. It's going to be at the Siskel Center for the Black Harvest Film Festival next week. Theodore Witcher's coming in. So we will talk with him about the legacy and the impact of that film, which, again, 20 years old. And of course, coming up at 9:30, Tracy Swartz will join us. Reality check. We'll talk about how our guys are doing on Bachelor in Paradise. But also, Love Blows starts this week. And we've got a divorce on Married at First Sight. Yeah, so if you're following, you know exactly what we're talking about. And tonight, of course, Sam Panionovich takes over Preps Plus Chicago at 10 o'clock. So we'll get to all the stuff before 10. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier, Roger Badish. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. Well, it's Friday afternoon, evening. I mean, there's never any news because most people are getting ready for the weekend. So we just sit back and reflect and what? Of course not. I'd hate to be the guy who's on the weekend shift at the CNN crawl, right? He just sat down with his dinner. He's got a hoagie. All the bells start going off from all the different desks. Ding, 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 ding. I mean, even Giancarlo Stanton hit 2 home runs already tonight. It's going to be, I nominate August 25th as the biggest Friday night news day of all time. How about that? Locally, just before quitting time, Governor Rauner decided it was the best time to use his veto pen to veto the $15 minimum wage bill. Not really much of a surprise. I mean, Rauner's a corporate businessman, and the last thing those guys like to do is pay anybody. But it's definitely setting up a fight in Springfield, right when all the fight should be directed at school funding. So we're going to see how that plays out. This would be for the state of Illinois. A minimum wage hike is already approved in Chicago. But still, this is a contentious issue. Be a leader, veto it on a Tuesday in the middle of the day. What is this Friday evening stuff? That's reserved for Kim Jong-un and President Trump. Governor Rauner, we expect more. Just because legislative leaders agreed behind closed doors on a new school funding bill, not everyone is on board. First, Governor Rauner was not too happy with the idea that Chicago would get more money than it was in SB1. He said in a speech today in Marion, Illinois, that he would work to reverse that part of the agreement. Some Republican representatives also said they would oppose any deal that would be a perceived bailout to Chicago. And even Chicago Democrats joined the opposition over any tax credits or public school funding going to private schools. Even the gubernatorial candidates got in the mix. We heard from Rauner. But on the Democrat side, Kennedy, Pawar, and Biss all opposed. The only person we haven't heard from, J.B. Pritzker. Very interesting. It looks like the Amazon deal for Whole Foods is a go, and we may see some prices drop as early as September. For example, avocados are going to be much cheaper. All right. Things are looking up. Okay, but what about the rest of Whole Foods? No? Grapes? We're not doing anything with grapes? Whole Foods grapes, man. The biggest highway robbery of all time. I'm paying like $11 for grapes. So don't talk to me, Amazon, about how great and how cheap the food is until you deal with the grapes. And that has been my commentary tonight. Things are looking up for Evanston high schoolers who want to wear leggings to school. Did you see this story? The dress code wars have let up, and the school said it's okay to wear leggings to school this year. There you go. Although that doesn't end the battle over leggings. The South Carolina principal is already in hot water for saying leggings are good for sizes 0 to 2. Anything bigger just makes kids look fat. Ooh, she pulled back on that pretty quick. So there you go, tight pants lovers. What was once banned because it was a distraction has now become the distraction. So now, could we work on banning ironic t-shirts? You know, if kids wear that, like the mechanic shirt, and their name's not Roy, they're out. In-school suspension, at least. In weather tonight, nice day. I'll be a little colder. I'm okay with, like, one more 90-degree stretch. Don't you think? Like, one more, like, four-day 90-degree stretch so we can soak it all up before the October winds come through. Other weather news, of course, Hurricane Harvey on its way to landfall in Texas. The governor's call for evacuations in Corpus Christi. Right now, Category 4 hurricane that could make landfall later tonight. You know what sucks? Late August, right? So I was thinking about this because a couple years back, it was the hurricane that came through the Houston area that had postponed a Cubs game. Remember that? Like, it was Carlos Zambrano, and they had to play it here. They moved it around. There's just a bunch of moving around. I think that some of the games didn't get redone, and it messed up all of the. The only reason I remember that is I was like, oh, it's right about this time of year. So it's almost to think about that, whatever that was, 5 years ago, whatever. It's the same concept, and not to mention Katrina. So this is just a terrible time for the South every single year. In sports, what's with the Cubs losing to the Reds last night? Right? Come on. I know baseball's pretty random, but the Reds, they're not random. They suck. Although the loss didn't mean much since the Cubs are still 3 up on the Brewers. Now they head to Philly for the weekend series. And once again, they find themselves in the fourth inning down 6-1. You got to beat the teams that are terrible, right? You can't let these games slip away. But this has been the Cubs' MO all year. They play up to the competition. They want it to be close when they got the 4-game set against the Brewers and the 4-game set against the Cardinals late in September. Otherwise, what's the point? It could be anticlimactic for them to be 8 games up, right? They want to be 2.5 up just to make it interesting. And for that, I say bravo, Cubs. And they're going to make more money, right? Wrigley Field. Ah, the Phillies. They've got the worst record in baseball. You know that? They're in a serious rebuild. I mean, I couldn't tell you one guy who is on this Phillies team. I mean, who even plays for the mighty Philadelphia Phillies anymore? Is Von Hayes still on the squad? Von Hayes still playing center field? How about Juan Samuel? Great second baseman. George Vukovic? Ozzie Virgil behind the plate? How about a Bake McBride? Right? I mean, please tell me that Bake McBride's playing tonight. Yeah, okay. Well, the Sox have brought up, 3 of their highly touted prospects this year, and 2 of them are now on the disabled list. Yoan Moncada hits the shelf with a bone contusion, i.e. shin splints. Well, that about wraps up the season. Thanks for watching, everybody. Oh, what? There's still a month left? Oh, great. The White Sox welcome to the, they welcome the Conor McGregor of baseball to the cell this weekend. See the Tigers yesterday against the Yankees. So much dumb baseball brawling. But usually brawls are adorable, but this one had sucker punches and just wouldn't stop. Went pretty much all game. So the Tigers, they come to the South Side all beat up and bruised this weekend. These two rivals are tanking on purpose, but they haven't seen each other since early June. Both sold off a ton of their assets at the trading deadline, and now are just playing out the string. Good news, Lucas Giolito in line for a start on Sunday, so at least he stays up. But the Tigers, I mean, they somehow kept Miguel Cabrera and Justin Verlander, but after that, who's left on this team, right? I mean, it begs the question, who plays for the Tigers this year? I mean, off the top of my head, it's Alan Trammell. Oh, we did. We did the Tigers. We did this already. We're just running out of teams. You're right. That does sound familiar. Lou Whitaker, Chet Lemon. Yeah. Okay, you're right. We did. By my calculations, the only teams left for 80s baseball jokes would be the Mets. We didn't do the Mets. Great 80s baseball names there. Tippy Martinez. Come on. The Cardinals, and we'll see them plenty in the month of September. Tommy Herr. Anybody for some Tommy Herr? Maybe the Angels? Because I would remember a Chili Davis. Feel like I don't think we got a Chili Davis in there. Anyway, Slim Pickens left Major League Baseball. We've done a good job this year, Pete. The Bears play the Titans in their third preseason game coming up on Sunday, noon kickoff. The NFL doing a little trial run for the regular season, a noon kickoff on a Sunday. Usually a preseason game like this is on a Tuesday night. But us fans, you know, we got to get ready too. I mean, how much queso do you put out before it congeals, right? I mean, when do you put the pizza rolls in? Right before halftime? Halftime? What, you got to work that out, right? And it's preseason for us too. How many beers is one too many beers? Lots to go over as a fan. You want to pull a quad this early, right? Running back and forth from the fridge. Luckily, this year, not unlike some other Bears seasons, when Devin Hester was on the Bears, you couldn't even go get a beer when there was a punt. But now you can go. There's nothing going on with Bears special teams. So what to look for on Sunday? Well, Coach Fox says that linebacker Danny Trevathan will make the trip to Nashville. He's ahead of his timetable for return for injury. That'd be huge, but he probably won't play. But great to see him suit up on opening day. Also, did you see 49ers linebacker Ahmad Brooks out of favor in San Francisco? Released outright. Hey, Fangio used to coach him there. I mean, make a move, right? Bring that dude in. He's a baller. Outside linebacker, knows the D. Maybe a little bit too much tread on the tires, but if this year's anything like last year, we'll need about 27 linebackers before the season's out. I don't know. And you know McPhee's not going to be ready till like midseason. We're joking ourselves that we're like, I think he might have a chance. No, it'll be any other day now when we hear week 7. Be ready for week 7. Come on, Bears, do it. Ahmad Brooks, bring him to Chicago. Also, play Trubisky. Now that I'm yelling at people, play Trubisky. All right, and finally tonight, Taylor Swift released a new song today. It's about time. We got a new Taylor Swift. It's about a new Taylor Swift, a Taylor Swift that's changed, and then the song's all about being mad at someone, so. I don't know. That sounds a lot like every Taylor Swift song. Can we put a moratorium on the pop diss tracks? Is there anything else to sing about? We get it. You don't like them. Sure. And you got boy troubles. Anything else? I mean, anything? Like sing about your favorite food? Or maybe about how cool your car is? Or take a page from Nicki Minaj and just sing about your butt? I mean, just sing about your butt. I guarantee it'll go down to number one. And people want to know why the music industry crashed. All right, that's the carryout for August 25th, 2017. Enjoy the weekend. Remember, when in doubt, carry out. All right, coming up, Theodore Witcher's going to join us, the writer and director of the film Love Jones, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. There's going to be a screening at the Siskel Center next week. So download 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Wow, just when I thought it was going to be a nice, relaxing Friday evening.
How about that? Mm-hmm. We don't have to reload this week's news. We can just do tonight's.
Yeah.
It's crazy. All right, well, let's get to it. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, all this month, the Black Harvest Film Festival is running at the Siskel Center downtown. It's the 23rd annual festival that celebrates the independent films and voices representing the Black experience. But the main attraction is a film that just turned 20. The film, Love Jones.
Sort of reminds me of stuff Gordon Parks was shooting for Life magazine.
Do you know a lot about photography?
A little something. I know that you have a great eye.
So you're just like a Renaissance Black man. Poetry, music, photography.
I think it was somebody that said something about Mozart. The goal of an artist is to create the definitive work that cannot be surpassed. I guess you can say I kind of live like that.
Well, that was actually George Bernard Shaw. Now you're trying too hard.
The movie, set in Chicago and shot here in Chicago, was released in 1997, featured Lawrence Tate and Nia Long. The movie was a love story, but also was a love letter to Chicago and its poetry scene, slam, beat, whatever you want to call it. It was all the rage in Chicago back in the late 90s and paved the way for the next generations to continue at places like Young Chicago Authors or Harold Washington Library. The film was written and directed by Columbia College grad Theodore Witcher. Witcher will be back in Chicago for the closing night screening of Love Jones, where he'll take part in an audience Q&A. This is next Thursday, but as of right now, the show sold out. Theodore Witcher currently lives out in L.A., but he joins us tonight. Theodore, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
What does it mean to you that you're celebrating the 20th anniversary of your film, Love Jones?
It means that I need reading glasses. That's the that's what it means to me. I never thought that, you know, when you make a film, you have an ambition that, or if you do anything, rather, you have an ambition that people will still be interested in it at some point in the future. You know, the fact that there's been a lot of buzz around this 20 years anniversary is very gratifying because it exceeded my my original ambition for the film.
You know, it's fun to look back at the film and look at it as a romantic movie. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call it a comedy, but it has comic elements. But the idea,
right, sure.
What kind of movie were you setting out to make back in 1997? What genre was this film supposed to be in?
I mean, they were making a lot of romantic comedies. I also don't really consider the movie a romantic comedy.
No, yeah.
It doesn't really follow that. It doesn't completely follow that structure, and it doesn't sort of end like a romantic comedy. But it has elements of that. I was trying to do a sort of hybrid between a romantic drama and something that had some comedic elements. As I said to everybody when we started off making the movie, that we were going to go through the drama door. We were going to try and find some rooms of comedy in the house. And if we could leave through the drama door, then that would be the intention for the film. So that's what we set out to do.
Well, it's
but
great.
It is kind of a bit of a hybrid.
Yeah, and,
right.
But it also is remembered, and it's fun reading about it. You know, it's a very mature romantic film. It didn't fall into stereotypes. It didn't, like you said, it didn't have the cliche endings that most movies who are going to be in love stories. And, you know, for
right.
you being a kid out of Columbia College, it always gets the label a mature film. It's, you know,
right.
Is that surprising to you that, you know?
I mean, you know, it's fun. What's surprising is I watched it a couple weeks ago. We screened it at the Academy here in Los Angeles. And, you know, there's actually some fairly crude humor in it as well, which kind of shocked me in my middle age. There's definitely the remnants of like a 20 something group of people who made the film and
right.
what is humorous to, you know, 20 somethings. But, you know, we tried to do something that was real and that had an emotional impact to it. But what I was conscious of, I didn't want to use or employ the conventions of melodrama. I wanted to keep it real, quote unquote, and relatable in terms of the style and the approach. But I didn't want to rely on tropes of gunplay or any sort of melodramatic element,
yeah.
because that's not, I mean, that is some people's lives, obviously, but that is not everybody's life. Everybody has a girlfriend that they're struggling with or a boyfriend that they're struggling with, some kind of relationship. So I really wanted to keep the scale more human and less larger than life. I wouldn't necessarily take that approach now, but that was what we tried to do at the time. So maybe that accounts for the maturity
yeah.
of it that you're speaking about.
And the actors in the film, I mean, Lorenz Tate and Nia Long, these are stars before you came along. You know, Nia Long,
sure.
All the movies that she was in at that time. For you being a first-time director, kid from Columbia College, what was that experience like to work with actors who've already been through the Hollywood machine and have done different things? Take us back 20 years ago to actually shooting Love Jones with the names that I just mentioned.
Well, it's always great to work with people who have experience. You know, they've made films before. They were very helpful. And, you know, Lorenz was a star, and Nia was a star as well. She'd been in a bunch of hit movies. You know, I didn't really have a problem with them on that level. I didn't feel like they treated me any differently, and I certainly didn't look at them in any sort of weird way, like I couldn't direct them. Once we got to Chicago to make the movie, from my standpoint, it felt very much like I expected an actor-director relationship to be, regardless of our relative levels of experience. You know, they came in with ideas. I come in with with ideas, and we hash it out and start shooting. And it was really no more complicated than that. They were the actors. I was the director, and we got to work making the film.
You know, one of the great characters of this film has to be the city of Chicago, the south side of Chicago as well, Hyde Park. But,
sure.
But talk about making a film like Love Jones and making sure that Chicago is a character in the film. I mean, when you see some of the shots, even some of the stuff I was looking at today, you know, you're shooting in record stores or where they're moving in front of the apartment building. There's such iconic
right.
Chicago landscape, but it's not Chicago right. landscape that you see all the time when you think of Chicago movies.
Right. Well, you always want to avoid, or at least I do, I try to avoid like the touristy kind of thing, like the postcard kind of thing, mm-hmm. even though you wind up with something like Buckingham Fountain in that section of the movie. But other than that, it's not really postcardy, is it?
No.
It's not really skyline-y, that type of photography. It's more like, no, these are the neighborhoods that these characters would live in. These are the places that they would go. You know, we used the wild hair. We used, the hotel ballroom downtown. And, clubs and houses on the South Street, on the South Side, rather, that regular people would go to, that I went to, that my friends went to. There was an effort to make it as much about the location and the place and the context for the story as possible. I almost wish, frankly, in watching it again, I almost wish I had done more of it, you know, because Chicago was so photogenic, certainly at that time. To answer your question, I guess we tried to do that. That was certainly part of the ambition for it. And just to keep it as regular people from Chicago, people from the South Side of Chicago especially, would be able to recognize all of the places or places that were like places that they would go to.
The movie Love Jones in 1997, it hit a chord for Chicagoans as well, because there weren't a lot of films at that time, especially ones that were set in Chicago, that were prominently displaying the African-American community or the South Side of Chicago
right.
in a way that wasn't stereotypical or that
sure.
Focusing on other issues. You know, to make
sure.
a romantic movie that stars Nia Long and Lorenz Tate and have it shot in Hyde Park and other South Side neighborhoods, you got to feel that this maybe that plays to the maturity a little bit, that this was a movie.
Right.
Real people live in these neighborhoods, and it's great to see a story that was real like that.
Yeah, well, that was what we tried to do. That's a part of life, too. The other stuff is as well, but not every movie has to be about that.
Right.
You know, I completely agree. That was my approach anyway. It seems to be, it shocks me or it amuses me that's such a thing. You know, it was a thing at the time, even, you know, amongst the financiers and various other people I showed the script to, that we were doing something that was so against the grain. But I felt that, you know, that's a part of the human experience as well. And why can't we tell a story about that?
Well, I wonder if it goes
in addition to all the other stories.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe it goes to the earlier point you made about melodrama, that more often than not, people will extract the melodrama or the stereotypes for big, broad strokes when they're making films, especially about a
right.
city.
Well, there's a reason for that. You know, it's easier to do the storytelling part when you go large like that. And generally, as I said to you earlier, I'm not sure I would take this approach if I was making the same kind of movie again, in that usually in a drama, the stakes do tend to be life or death. And that goes back about 2,000 years
right,
to when
right.
the Greeks invented drama. But on this one, I felt I wanted to keep it a little more. That was my instinct, was to keep it a little more human scale. I don't know if that paid off. I guess it did. People still like the movie 20 years later.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a reason why movies tend to use gunplay and violence and that kind of stuff, because it amps up the stakes. It's riveting, quite frankly.
Theodore Witcher is the director and filmmaker, the writer of the movie Love Jones, which came out 20 years ago this year. It's mm-hmm. going to be screened at the Black Harvest Film Festival at the Siskel Center. The closing night, Thursday night, Theodore will be in town for a Q&A. That Q&A is sold out. When I think about, and I mentioned at the beginning of this movie, this also not only a love letter to Chicago, but a love letter to Chicago's poetry scene. To
sure.
put the main character, Lorenz Tate, as a slam poet, to honor a scene that was burgeoning at the time. I know that scene very well, and there's a lot of people I still pay attention to and I'm friends with that were a part of a South Side poetry scene that was
right.
unrivaled. There were some talent that the city's never seen before coming out. How important was it for you to make a movie, not just that was a romantic film, but also one that included that aspect?
Well, I love that scene. I fell into it by accident. I was in school at Columbia, and somebody said, "Why don't you?" You know, I ran into somebody at the Hokin, at the student center. They were like, "You know, we do this open mic thing on Monday nights. Why don't you come by? You might dig it." And I went with a friend of mine and just fell in love with the scene and became a sort of regular. There was a club called Spices that we used to do poetry at every Monday night. And then there were some other places, you know, you'd find us at like the Hot House or some other, you know, or some party or something going on the South Side somewhere. But Spices was the main venue. And I knew everybody on the scene. Everybody knew me. And we had a whole thing there. And as I was living it, in the back of my mind, I thought, wow, this is such an interesting vibe that it would be great to be able to have a movie that had this as its world, right? That had this as the context for some other kind of story that you could lay on top of it. But it's so idiosyncratic and so insular. I never thought that I could get anybody in Hollywood to, you know, to make a studio movie set in this world.
Right.
So I was as shocked as anybody when we got the thing made. But it was very important for me to put that world on screen because we'd never really seen it before. I thought it was fresh and unique and that audiences would be intrigued by it. And I think they were.
Of course, the scene was great here in Chicago in the late 90s, but the movie glorified it, made it a big thing. And then out of that came Young Chicago Authors and some of the programs for After School Matters and Chicago Public Schools. And although those kids are the Chance the Rappers and the kids who came out, all the kids in Chicago that are the hip-hop right. stars of America right now all came from the poetry scene in Chicago. So obviously the scene that you're featuring in Love Jones is not the first poetry scene in Chicago, but the idea that it's this legacy that could be part of how these kids saw this and wanted to be a part of it.
And not just with the poetry in the movie, with the music in the movie and the dancing in the movie and all of the cultural specificity, the black cultural specificity of the movie, it was absolutely the intention was to display that in a way that a mass audience could see and get into and recognize and maybe be intrigued by if they weren't familiar with and spur all kinds of creativity out of it in whatever discipline, not just poetry. So if a modicum of that, a tiny sliver of that actually happened in real life as a result of the movie, then I'm very happy.
Yeah, there you go. And we didn't even get a chance to talk about the soundtrack. That's the best.
Oh, yeah. That's
amazing thing, right? Soundtrack, one of the best movie soundtracks with Lauryn Hill and so many other great things on
that. Yeah, we got lucky there. We got lucky with all those artists.
It's unbelievable. Theodore Witcher is the filmmaker, the writer and director of the film Love Jones, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary. It'll be screened at the Black Harvest Film Festival at the Siskel Center next Thursday. Theodore will be in town for a Q&A, and he will be on set sold out. But if, you know, you can stand out in front, maybe. Scalp a ticket. I don't know how it works. Theodore Witcher.
Say hello, at least.
Yeah, say hello. That's right. Theodore Witcher, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Justin. I appreciate it.
The sweetest thing I've ever known was like the kiss on a collarbone. The soft caress of happiness. The way you are, your style of dress. I wish I didn't get so weak. Oh, ooh, baby, just to hear you speak. Makes me argue just to see how much you're in love with me. See, like a queen, a queen.
Good stuff. Love Jones, 20 years old. Man, that soundtrack is amazing. I listened to it all day today. Lauryn Hill is on that soundtrack. the Refugee All-Stars, they call them, not the Fugees because they couldn't get them. There are all sorts of songs that still today are spun on radio stations and, you know, and CDs from that soundtrack. Pretty great. We didn't even get into it. I was kind of annoyed at the end there. I'm like, I want to talk more about the soundtrack. But the movie turns 20. All right, coming up, we're going to reload this week's news, or just tonight's news, because there's so much that just happened in the last hour and a half, from weather-related stuff with the hurricane going from the that's beating down on Texas, going from a 3 to a 4, category 3 to a 4. The sheriff in Arizona, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, being pardoned by the President of the United States. It's pretty crazy. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about here in the state of Illinois, Governor Rauner vetoing the minimum wage, the $15 minimum wage, and much more. I mean, it's been such a big week when it comes to the news. So we'll reload biggest stories, winners, losers, overreported, underreported, which story sucks it down the rabbit hole, and which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from this week. I have a feeling it's going to be the eclipse. Perhaps. Thank you, Rob. Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time to reload this week's news, tonight's news. The last 15 minutes news, I feel like.
The last 30 seconds.
All right. It keeps
What's
coming.
What's happened?
312-981-7200. Tonight, we reload this week's news, biggest stories, winners, losers, overreported, underreported, which story took you down the rabbit hole, and which story will be remembered from this week in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this week. Craig Newman in studio. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you.
It's been a while. Former managing editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, Cranes as well, does a newsletter for them, freelance journalist. Thanks for being here, bud.
Been a minute. Good to be here.
And good to see you, Nyla Boodoo. Nyla.
Hey, Justin Kaufman.
All right. I've worked with Nyla a big chunk of my career. Nyla, the host of The 21st, which is a talk show that is aired all over the state on Illinois Public Radio. Nyla, great to see you.
It's good to be here, Justin.
All right.
So Fun fact, we've actually known each other a while, but have not met
this
in person.
This is our first real life meeting.
That's what I like to do. I like to facilitate.
Bring people together.
The network. All right, let's get into it. Biggest story, and I've been making the joke all night about, you know, we could just do this whole segment based on what's happened in the last hour. But it really doesn't, all of the stuff doesn't trump, no pun intended. I would say that the pardoning of Joe Arpaio's up there. I would say that the Category 4 hurricane that's hitting Texas as we speak is up
Hurricane
there.
Hurricane Harvey, right. Because we don't know. That may end up being the biggest story.
Right. Those are up there, but for Illinois and for us, Craig, you say the biggest story is what's happening in Springfield with the school funding formula.
Yeah, indeed. You know, but part of it's the fight that's just been ongoing and the uncertainty and the questions about how these schools are going to survive throughout the state. And part of it, you know, I'm a CPS parent. Every year we struggle to figure out what's going on around here. So anytime there's money being withheld or promises not being kept, it's kind of a catastrophe. But you know, this is almost a hard story to put up there at the front. We were talking about this a little bit before we went on air. You've got the leadership down there saying we've got a deal. You've got Rauner, who the governor, who said last night we probably have a deal that he's happy with. And then all of a sudden he's taking a step back downstate today and doing his Chicago's no good dance. And then you've got Will Guzzardi, who is the
Democrat,
majority whip.
Democrat representative here in Chicago. Right?
Here in Chicago, who all of a sudden is calling us some sort of right-wing conspiracy for
the
money.
He called it a poison
schools.
Pill. The Catholic school, the private, the idea of public money going to private school. I mean, this is, I haven't in the category for winners as well. I think that Jim Durkin and the Republicans get a win this week just for the fact that they were able to change the course of school funding and the idea of getting something on the books that you would never think would be in the blue state of Illinois, school choice.
So they don't want to call it a voucher program. It's $75 million. I think obviously Cardinal Cibich has a big part in bringing this up. All of a sudden, this has sort of kind of slipped in here in this conversation in the past couple of weeks. I mean, the school funding conversation, Justin, has been going on for years. You have folks like Senator Andy Menar. Mm-hmm. You and I in Springfield, like 5 years ago,
he was down there
peddling this. I've got this funding formula. We're bipartisan. We're working on this. he went through several changes of how he thought about his position. We thought we had this bipartisan deal. And I think now maybe we do have a bipartisan deal with this $75 million. Is it just all talk on both sides? Is it just both the left and the right, Governor Rauner, Will Guzzardi, kind of this is their political covers they're kind of complaining about? Right.
Yeah,
it's a question.
It very well could be the cover. It's interesting that it got slipped in. And it's not an inconsequential item to slip into a funding measure, right?
Well, and it's the fact that it's actually happening.
Right.
This is a first for Illinois.
The school choice, yeah. It's something that is a head-scratcher that this was put into a school funding formula.
Well, that's evidence-based. Yeah. So if we remember, this is based on the numbers of students that you have. And so then if you have an opportunity for those students to then, those parents to take that money and go to a private school, how does that affect the formula? Because again, if this is all based on a new model of looking at not just the students, but how much money the districts
have. Right.
And correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know that the Cardinal Blaise Cupich here in Chicago was instrumental in getting this measure put in. And he was instrumental in getting this deal put together because of this. This tied the two sides together. What I haven't seen is how this affects the Chicago Catholic schools, which have been in rough shape the last few years. They've been dwindling. It's a dwindling student body. They're trying to figure out how to make things meet. And all of a sudden, we've got a big win for the Cardinal. It seems like there's going to be some stories to be reported out over the next few days.
The other part of it, too, is and I think the process is makes this a big story, too. The idea of behind closed doors, legislative leaders coming out saying, we got something together, but we're not going to tell you what it is. We're going to put this bill together. There's so much that goes into the political games that are being played in Springfield with the budget, now with school funding, that it seems like people in this state, voters and citizens are starting to get fed up with the idea that it's not the legislature we knew. Now it's something new. Everything changes, and they're going to try to ram things down our throats, whether we like it or not.
Well, the important thing to remember out of all of this is that next Tuesday, is the third payment that was supposed to be sent to school districts across the state, right? So we have two payments already the state has missed that they owed to K-12 because no one's figured out how to pay them. Tuesday is the day you had superintendents in Springfield from around the state standing up. I think it was Thursday. At this point, I feel like the days are kind of blurring together of everything that happened, saying we're demanding that Tuesday has to be the deadline because we have districts. I have talked to district school superintendents who say we open. We don't have enough money to function past October. So we open in September. Maybe we have enough money for October. We really didn't have that money to begin with. We're really in a mess, and you still haven't sent us the money.
You know, I'm interested. The one power player that has been quiet, that has obviously put out negative statements, is the Chicago Teachers Union. They've had a big voice, at least, if not a seat at the table, a voice when it comes to school funding, and especially Chicago Public Schools. They are on the losing end in this deal because no one from that camp wants to see any public dollars being siphoned off for private institutions. Where do they stand? I mean, they still have yet to organize and raise a stink if need be, and that could actually cause a lot of problems for state legislators down in Springfield.
Absolutely, and I've not seen, just reading the headlines in the last couple of hours, that there's any reaction from them whatsoever.
There's also just no details about any of this.
I think that's the other important thing
is that we're not clear how much, if CPS stands to gain more, which is what Mayor Emanuel has said, or if we believe what Governor Rauner says, that of course we're not letting Chicago rob the coffers as sort of his kind of ongoing. We don't know the details of any of this. So perhaps on Sunday we'll start to see some of this when they get together.
Mike Fouché was on last night, and he was at the Emanuel presser, where he was giddy, where Emanuel had his smile on his face. I can't say anything. You know, his weird way that he did that in press conference. I shouldn't say anything.
But
there was a point in there that the mayor's office has tried to push back on, although they still have not answered the question, where a reporter asked, I think Mike said it was Mike Flannery from Fox, said, will residents of Chicago, will they be fitting the bill for this? Will property taxes go up? And he said yes. He said yes, and then he paused, and he bounced off of it, and he wasn't sure, and he's like, well, and he hemmed and hawed, went back to talking points. But just to your point, Nyla, we don't know what's in this. It may be a win in the sense that Chicago is getting more money for schools, but it also may be on the backs of the people who pay taxes in the city of Chicago.
When is the answer no? to that. Right. I mean, if property,
everyone forgets the deeper fundamental problems that this state is in when we're talking about pensions. The sad fact is that things have gotten so bad that we don't have enough money for our public schools to open just because lawmakers can't figure things out. But there are much deeper problems that taxpayers ultimately have to.
Comes to an old deal that they're capped. I mean, there is a cap on how much property tax can be used for Chicago public schools. The question is being asked and has not been answered by the mayor's office. Is that in play? Does that cap go up? You know, the idea that the taxpayers of the city of Chicago are on the hook. That's a big part of this, a shoe that has yet to, I won't say drop, but just been taken off.
Yeah, and you know, by the way, kind of on the quiet after this news started to come out, the CPS is also looking to sell $1.9 billion, you know, with their junk status in bonds. So I think or in debt. So we've got other, you know, fish, not Asian carp.
There are a lot of stories to get to tonight, just the stories that were breaking between 5 and now. Craig Newman, Nyla Boodoo in studio. We'll come back. We'll do winners, losers, and continue reloading.
We didn't even mention the eclipse.
312-981-7200. If you're going to weigh in, now's the time. Stay with us. We're reloading this week's news. Craig Newman and Nyla Boodoo in studio.
Where are the hot dogs?
I know the hot dogs are in Chicago's best. They don't drop them off to us. All right, so let's get into winners and losers. This is one of these weeks. I mean, when you talk about all the stories that just happened in the last hour, that you can really put any story in any category. So, you know, I will say winners tonight, and we'll start off this conversation that really encompasses a lot of different categories. Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona, pardoned tonight by the White House, by President Trump. First presidential pardon for Donald Trump. I would say a winner for not only for the sheriff that he gets to get out of jail, but also for people who want a stronger stance on immigration and feel that Sheriff Arpaio was doing America's work by racially profiling Latinos in Arizona and being unabashed about it and essentially saying, I'm doing it. I don't care what anybody says. You can argue winners and losers, absolutely, on whether or not that's right for the country. But in the case of getting out of jail, Sheriff Joe Arpaio is a winner.
In a way, stunning but not stunning, right? That this is the first presidential pardon, which, Craig, I think, you know, if we were just talking about this before we're on air, it is significant that this is the first presidential pardon.
Absolutely.
But basically, President Trump basically said on Tuesday night, I'm going to pardon him. He also said that as well.
Right.
But, you know, yes, it's no doubt a win for Sheriff Joe, who, you know, we can leave aside the discussion about the kind of person he is and the kind of law enforcement that he ran in his county. It is interesting that your first pardon as a president comes to one of your most ardent early supporters. This is very much a politically motivated pardon. Of course, that doesn't affect Joe other than the fact that he's not going to have to serve his sentence for violating court order. But, you know, he's a man who has been very strident in his beliefs. They dovetail quite nicely with the president's. And, yeah, it was pretty apparent.
Let me ask you this question. Nyla, I know you've done a lot in immigration in your career, and Craig, you too at the Sun-Times. The question I have is he pardoned for the act in which, and the way that I interpret it, the idea that essentially in his county, he was instructing his officers to pull people over because they were of Hispanic descent or had brown skin.
Probably me, because I'm brown.
Sure, brown skin, to see if they were documented. And that was the idea, that he was like, you know what, more the hedge in the bet there is that more were undocumented than documented, and he can catch people who were actually breaking immigration law faster this way. Which is, abhorrent when you think about it being unconstitutional. Anyone who was American who got caught up in any sort of sting like that, that's the worst thing that could possibly happen, and have some empathy to understand if that could happen to you. But the idea being is he being pardoned because of that principle, or is he just being pardoned because of the political, and this is an advocate for Donald Trump?
Well, I think if you would listen to what President Trump said on Tuesday night, I think it would be the latter, that he's being pardoned for someone who represents to President Trump the philosophy of building the walls. President Trump on Tuesday talked about liberating our cities, keeping us safe from the animals. I mean, I think it's sort of that's the kind of philosophy that I think, in my mind, I would say from a broader President Trump, from someone on the outside trying to understand a little bit of the thinking behind it. Mm-hmm. That I would say he represents that.
Yeah. Yeah, I've not had a chance to read the reasoning or the language around the pardon. Hour, yeah. My suspicion is that he's being pardoned as a person who was under political persecution, which is somewhat ironic when you consider why he was being punished.
Right. Well, and Justin, you talked about winners and losers. When we think about this, and this is what was going to be one of my underreported stories, you're talking about immigration. One of the big conversations all week has been about, and I think this story might have escaped a lot of people's notice, that there was a young woman who was being held in first McHenry County and then another jail in Illinois because it was this is the last stop before being deported. This is a 22-year-old woman who has protection under DACA. So deferred action for childhood arrivals.
This is the DREAM Act.
Not the DREAM Act, because the DREAM Act has actually never been passed.
But that's the idea behind
it. This is President Obama's executive orders.
This is the
idea.
Right,
so if you came here as a kid,
right?
So she's 22. Right. I believe she came here from Honduras when she was like 6 or 7. A 22-year-old mom who has an 11-month-old and a 5-year-old goes to pick up a member of her church to the detention facility because they say you're the one who has legal status, so you can go. And she gets there and they say, hold up, what's your name? Wait, we have a deportation order from you from like, I don't know exactly. I think it was like 2004, 2005. Mm-hmm. And she says, but I have DACA. And they say, that doesn't matter.
We don't care anymore, right?
And so this happens a week ago. 2 days ago, Senator Durbin starts talking about it because he hears that she's in a detention facility in Illinois. She was picked up in Kentucky. Her lawyers are starting to try to get attention for this. Her husband says that when they called, she was moved 4 to 5 times between in this week that she was held by ICE. And her husband says when he called and said, my wife has legal status. She has DACA. He says that the ICE officials say that there's no DACA under President Trump.
By the way,
President Trump talked to us today about rescinding DACA.
Right, that's where we're at.
And he has September, so that's a really important deadline. September is sort of the time frame for whether or not he's going to rescind this executive order.
It brings the question I have, and this is a lot of...
This is 800,000 people we're talking about here.
Undocumented immigrants who didn't want to come forward for DACA because they said, well, are you sure this is going... I don't want to be on a list. I want to do all this stuff and President Obama said, no, we're going to do this. You got our word. You got the government's word. And then it comes out this week that President Trump is like, no, you don't. And possibly going to rescind an executive order coming up in September. This is the precursor. This story is exactly the nightmare kind
of
story.
And this is exactly, I was talking to Senator Durbin about this morning, and he said this would be a travesty if this happened. If we're thinking about... We think about these 800,000, to Senator Durbin's words, young people who are Americans, who came here as children, who are attending college or college graduates or working. That's kind of, they've gone through a program. They've gone through a process. They have to apply every 2 years. And they trusted the government to come forward.
Regardless of how you believe or where you stand on immigration or even undocumented immigrants, the idea of this story is that the government said, come forward. This is the rule of law. People did that, and now there's a chance that they could be betrayed.
They could use that.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think the phrase was literally, we want you to come out of the shadows.
Right.
We want to be able to document you. We want you to pay taxes. We want you to be a productive member of society. We want you to contribute to the GDP. Now, this is a chilling effect beyond chilling.
And I think that's the other thing is when you look at what happened in a microcosm to states like Alabama when they cracked down into what happened to their economy, you look at the fact that generally among the business community, you know, immigration reform and all of this has been something that's brought together things like the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO and the Catholic Church and all of these groups that normally would not maybe necessarily
there's
be working together. There's a problem here, right?
And well, there's almost nobody who's saying that the DACA folks
well,
are
in fact,
bad.
Right. In fact, I think it was 6 Republican lawmakers sent President Trump a letter yesterday saying, including like Ileana Ross-Leighton from Florida, saying, you've got to keep this program.
Who is leaving
now,
her office?
Craig, let me ask you as we'll wrap up here before we go to the news. But the governor as well, he kind of, it's a strange thing this week where he's got an immigration law.
Right, the Trust Act is supposed to be signed on Monday.
Where I think Breitbart came out and said this is fine, it's reasonable. But Joe Walsh, our favorite congressman turned talk show host, said, no, Governor Rauner's done. And the papers like kind of made it like the right wing was mad at Governor Rauner. But, I mean, there has been, it still is a bill, the Trust Act. It's not necessary. It's just saying, hey, you know what, law enforcement is not going to help out ICE over and beyond.
All it says is, unless there's a warrant,
Right.
That's basically like law enforcement will honor warrants by judges and nothing else. And I will say,
really not even about them to prioritize.
Right. It's not even about immigration.
I will say the Illinois Sheriff's Association has, like they said to me, we've signed off on this bill. They worked with all these immigrant groups. The immigrant groups worked with law enforcement. There was bipartisan support for this bill. So, yeah.
Well, I think this is another chance for the governor to come out and say whether he believes in the president's agenda or not. You know, this is another instance where he seems not to agree, but who really knows? Right. Because he's allergic to making statements.
If we've seen anything, he won't say a word. Nyla Boodoo, Craig Newman. In studio tonight, we just went through the winners talking immigration. Let's talk losers. Let's talk losers when we come back after Rob's news. We're reloading the news here on the download. Stay with us. All right. Thank you, Rob. It's download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Nyla Boodoo, the host of The 21st, which is a talk show in Illinois Public Radio. You can hear it all over the state of Illinois, Monday through Friday. Craig Newman, longtime journalist, freelance journalist now, but former managing editor at the Chicago Sun-Times. In Reloading the News tonight, 312-981-7200, just so we can move on from the immigration stuff. 847 says, I find the pardon appalling. It says a lot about 45 and not in a good way. Sheriff Arpaio is a racist, in my opinion. I think immigration could use some fixing, but 45 is going about it the wrong way. I am angry. But 815 also says, I don't think you can judge a man unless you know what a border state deals with. It's interesting, too. And then I misspoke, and people loved it when I misspoke. It was a misdemeanor charge. He wasn't in jail, but it was a criminal contempt for Joel.
I will wear the jacket on that as well. I will pardon you for your
mistake.
Thank
you. Thank you.
I've been pardoning you for your mistakes for a long time, Justin.
But right, 630 also says, I would seriously doubt that even if Trump didn't pardon him, that he would have seen jail time. So this is much more political posturing by the president. All right, so let's move on to losers tonight. And let's stay with the president of the United States, President Donald Trump, who, I mean, really has had an up and down week, a week that ends even tonight as so many different things with the pardon, but also some staffers out at the White House. Seems like Friday night's becoming buzz night for the White House. But, I mean, it started with the president on Monday giving a somber speech that felt that President Trump may just very well be in the winners category with outlining what he wants to do with the war in Afghanistan, looking very presidential in an address to the nation in front of the military.
Not going off script,
but then he goes to Arizona, he has his rally, and it just kind of all falls apart, the stories of what's happening there. But, I mean, people outside, the protests, but also just a rambling speech where I think CNN said 50. There was a piece that was like 57 things that Trump said tonight that you need to know about.
He was at one point he said on Tuesday night, the fake news. All this, look at all the red lights. They're turning their cameras off. CNN's not caring me. CNN's not caring what I'm saying. And I was watching that on CNN. I'm watching this happen.
What's happening?
On CNN.
Were you? Are you sure?
Yeah, the president.
Well, and then the thing was I tweeted it, and all these other people were tweeting it like, yes, you were, because I was watching it on CNN, too, and I was like, yes, millions of people are watching this on CNN.
It seemed like he was just riding all over everything. Every topic he could, it was like a kid with ADD.
Back to Monday night, Justin, Afghanistan, where he says a complete reversal of everything he had campaigned for on Afghanistan and says, well, it's different once you get to the president's
desk. And by the way, a complete reversal of what his base wants to see. They do not want to be in Afghanistan. They are tired of nation building. They're tired of, you know, it's a very isolationist crowd.
Right.
And this is the opposite of that. Although it's a very tepid reversal for Trump.
But the only pushback I have is that he recognizes that, at least in the speech, he recognizes that we're not going to be nation, but we're going to win.
Yes.
I mean, if anything, I think
we don't know what that means.
Yeah,
but
I think he offended both sides.
Yeah.
Well, I was actually talking to Senator Duckworth. Everybody's around now, right, because they're off in recess, and was talking to her about this week, and she said she made two points. She took issue with him saying we're going to win and that the honor of our troops depend on winning, because she said, I just want to say, as a veteran, The honor of our troops have nothing to do with whether or not there's a success in this mission.
Say, there was a lot.
And
it's
we
been 16
cannot
years, right?
say that the people who have served in Afghanistan that haven't served with honor because of what has happened there.
Like, and what I really wanted to hear from that speech, although I suppose I didn't expect that I would hear it, but I wanted to see some policy come out afterwards, was what does winning mean? How long are we going to be there?
Which is precisely right.
What is 4,000 troops going to do? And we still haven't seen the exact number, but that's the number that's being reported. You know, you're only talking about 12,000 U.S. troops there. The Taliban is resurgent. They were talking about maybe getting into negotiations with the Taliban all of a sudden. You know, and it should be pointed out that the war powers the president's acting under are 17 plus years old now. They've not been revised since September 11th. We're fighting wars across a couple of countries yeah. that we haven't
War by executive order,
again.
Right, yeah. right. Which is strange. I mean, you'd think that after seven, especially with the change in transition in power, there would be at some point or another, and I don't even mean even before President Obama, would be in a position where we would try to reset the American way in which we conduct military operations, but it hasn't happened. And here we are where, you know, the president can say this. I mean, he is commander in chief and he has the ability, but
absolutely.
But Congress,
well,
has
Congress
just been ridiculous.
Congress
not even
has
part
to fund
of
it.
It. Yeah.
That's the other part of this, right?
But they've also largely abdicated their responsibility there. But, you know, I don't want to get us off topic about who the loser is.
Well, also, so with President Trump, and this is the part I think that puts him in the category, is there was just so much thrown out in that speech in Arizona that even up to today, people are fact-checking and questioning. I mean, the wall is a great example of this idea that there needs to be a wall or I'm going to shut down the government. And then they go back to the campaign. I thought Mexico was going to pay for this wall. Now we're paying for this wall, and he's going to shut down the government to get it. I mean, and then you hear Sarah Huckabee Sanders say, well, the nation spoke. There's a mandate for the wall. This is what people want. I mean, it's almost like it's revisionist history within just months of what
days,
was
wrong.
I mean, and I think that just
cases.
Throws you off.
Well,
yeah.
And, you know, in between getting into a shooting match with Mitch McConnell, he hasn't really brought up Ryan, but his congressional leadership who controls Congress, the Republicans who control Congress, have no appetite for shutting down the government. And they've said as much. So, I don't know where he's going with that. But, you know, the idea of being a loser gets back to every time Trump does something presidential, and it's not often terribly, but this speech was one, you know, his speech to the joint session of Congress was another. It has a life cycle of about 24 hours before he's done something else to right. turn everybody's attention.
Well, I mean, today the approval ratings come out again. I mean, he's at the lowest point. It's 34%. It doesn't. And you know, all that aside, because I will agree that I don't know. I mean, those are he says it. He says it. I don't want to be a talking head for the president, but he says it as well, that the polls are wrong for the election. You know, they're wrong in the sense that of who's actually supporting him, but it is a low approval rate from objective sources. And the question I have to you guys, to the panel, is just, you know, when you get to these ideas of the big ticket items that he needs to take on or wants to take on, we talk about tax reform, we talk about the infrastructure plan that he announced,
do you want to mention health care?
Well, I was going to say the reason, remember the whole Charlottesville stuff last week, that was a press conference for infrastructure that all came out of.
This is true.
But, and even
we
now,
all remember
now
infrastructure
now we,
week.
Yeah, right,
it was
right.
fantastic.
And then of course, the idea of the wall and shutting down the government and the debt ceiling. And I mean, you get to this point where you're like, if he doesn't do well in the next 2 or 3 weeks with these big ticket projects that Republicans are already scratching their head at, I mean, does the approval rating go even worse? I mean, does Americans, even some of his base, go, all right, you're not playing the game right?
Yeah, and I don't think he's quite I'm not sure if he hasn't figured out how to work with Congress or if he has no appetite for it. You know, I think we see a president who's very comfortable doing his rallies. That's where he lives. That's where he likes to be. That's where he can read the crowd and react to it. With Congress, it's a much more difficult deal. There's ramifications. There's real-world policy. There's money that has to be dealt with. And there's a limited appetite for dealing with demagoguery, even, you know, at the top congressional levels on both sides. So, you know, I think the wall he's building is the one between himself and the Hill in a lot of respects. And, you know, they're jettisoning White House staffers in a hope to maybe legitimize the government a little bit from that respect. And I don't know if that's John Kelly's influence or what. But, you know, he still can't get out of his own way. You know, they find a win. They find some momentum, and then it just is gone in a blip of time.
Well, tonight, of course, as you mentioned, staffer Sebastian Gorka, advisor to the president. The White House is saying he didn't resign, but they're saying he doesn't work here anymore. They're being very weird with the way that they do this. It's only been 1 week since Steve Bannon. I mean, that's crazy to think about.
Where Gorka came from, by the way.
Breitbart. Yeah, right, from Breitbart. And, I mean, it's just only been a week. It's only been a week since.
But then, remember, Scaramucci was a week before.
Right.
Just wanted to add that in there.
It's only been 2 weeks.
And Gorka's wife still works in the White House.
So here's what we'll do. Let's take a break so we can stay on time tonight. And we'll come back. And I have some other losers, and I want to get into overreported and underreported. But we should make a transition back to the state of Illinois because Governor Rauner falls into
Speaking
the category
of staff transitions.
With staff transitions, I mean, we just saw yesterday a turnover of what, 4 or 5 staffers in the communications staff.
General counsel,
the brand new
general counsel. After he said that he wasn't going to do that, they did it.
That it was fake news.
You get to a certain point where you see a lot of similar parallels, and he obviously says
he's
that's
more
not
like
the
president than he likes to let on.
And so we'll talk about Governor Rauner's week and why we have him in the losers category. But we can push back on that as well because obviously he's. You know, he's a part of the school funding debate as well in Springfield. Craig Newman, Nyla Boodoo in studio tonight. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Stay with us. All right, 312-981-7200. We're reloading this week's news, Nyla Boodoo and Craig Newman in studio. We are firmly into the loser category now, overreported.
Wait, are we losers here?
We are the losers, and we're talking about other losers this week. We're going to get to this. Then we got overreported, underreported, which stories took us down the rabbit hole, and what story from this week will be remembered. All right, let's get right to the loser category, and Governor Rauner falls into this category.
Now, I would say this is communication staff that is now here, no longer here, would fall into.
So let's talk about this.
Category.
So this is a simmer story. This is one that started, and you're like, what is happening with a possibly racist cartoon that was done by the Illinois Policy Institute, which has ties to Rauner, but not really Rauner's office? And you saw it, and you went, oh, that's kind of ugly. And it just didn't go away.
Well, Marian Ahern kept tweeting at Governor Rauner and asking at every, and the response just was, haven't seen the cartoon.
Yeah, it's almost.
So
I guess
like I will say the story kept going
because of him.
Because Governor Rauner kept saying, "I haven't seen it."
Yeah, he tried to avoid it. He tried
Craig,
to deflect
it. To your point
it.
Earlier about not taking a stand on an issue. Have you seen it? What do you think of it? When you have a moment where bipartisan lawmakers are calling the cartoon, well, we cannot say on the air what they call the cartoon, not even on WGN. It can't say it on Public Radio. Can't say it on. And then you have sort of this moment where everyone says, this is ugly, Democrats and Republicans in the state house.
He could have easily put out a statement saying there's no place for this kind of thing. Move on.
Yeah.
And he didn't.
And it would have ended.
It would have ended.
It's almost like politicians don't remember how to do boilerplate nonsense statements anymore. You know, you can't do away with a controversy in any sort of smart way. You got to, oh, my account was hacked. I didn't see it. I don't know what. Show me the cartoon. Oh, that's terrible. We shouldn't do this. And we've all moved on.
Right.
We'll find out who's responsible and we'll.
So, right, this goes on through the state fair last week. And then on Tuesday,
it
was it?
The butter cow.
It might have overshadowed the butter cow. Marian Ahern speaks to Governor Rauner's staff and gets an email saying, as a white male, Governor Rauner doesn't think it's his place to comment on the cartoon.
Yeah. That's the weirdest statement, I think, in Illinois political history. The idea that he says in a statement that's from his office, and we'll get to the second part of that story, but he as a white man, he has nothing else to add. It, automatically, everyone goes, and there was some great, I think, I forgot who said it, one, a great journalist, maybe it was Steinberg, somebody said the idea that nobody asked you personally what you think. You're the governor. You have to represent
We're not
all,
asking you as a white man. We're asking you as the governor
you
of Illinois.
You have to speak for everybody, right?
Although, when you have to insert that you are a white man and thereby can't comment on it, I think you pretty much just commented on it, that there it is a racist cartoon.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. And so, I don't know the timeline, but the governor gets a hold of this statement. He's behind the scenes,
so that's,
livid.
So that's around like 11 or noon. Like that's sometime in the middle of the day. That there maybe in the afternoon that this happens, right? And then, and so a couple people, like, I see the statement. I remember this is in the afternoon. I'm emailing Governor Rauner's office saying, is there a statement? Did you say this? So we're emailing spokeswoman Laurel Patrick about this. And then at 9:30 p.m., a statement comes out from Governor Rauner's office saying that the earlier statements did not accurately reflect his views. And then it was sort of like a both sides kind of thing. I could see that some people say this cartoon is problematic, but others don't.
Yeah. Well, what happens, and then, okay. Yeah, and then I let this fast forward to the next day. The communication staff that put together this statement is out. The same staff that just a week before, 37 days before, Governor Rauner said we've assembled the best team in America. There was a lot of questions about why that staff was put in and replaced the staff that was outgoing. It's tumult.
Best team in America. It's not like they traded for Kyrie Irving or anything. See, I was going to get
that. Oh, you got it in. You got it in.
But you know, I think that's why. I think that there was a lot of even hyperbole. The best team in America, and this is the right squad. And there was a lot of question.
That we haven't made, that a lot of these folks came from the Illinois Policy Institute, right, which is the same organization that created the cartoon.
Right.
That they did take down, but would not apologize now, for.
You know, the cartoon in general, I mean, we could have an argument all night about it. I mean, I think that it was insensitive. And when I look at it, I'm not sure. I mean, I get what it's one of those pieces of content where you're like, yeah, I think you're being sarcastic, but it doesn't read that way. So therefore it's racist, you know, like, and I know I can understand the Illinois Policy Institute, and they got Charles Thomas to write something on behalf of them saying it's not racist. This is a distraction. They got some people to come out.
But that's the whole point of why they put these cartoons out. It's because they want it to be a distraction. They want everybody to talk about it.
There's no reason to do a political cartoon if it's not going to make people
that's
mad.
That's the whole point of a political cartoon.
It's to engender some sort of reaction. Right.
And so, I will, again, go to your point from the beginning that I don't think this story would have gone on as long as it had
if he would have gotten in front of it.
So in the end, it was mismanaged communication.
So now, beyond that, you have Governor Rauner, who has essentially been removed from the negotiation over school funding. I mean, you had the legislative leaders behind closed doors. He was not part of that. Even in a strange way, this, like you said, today, downstate, saying he's not even sure he's in for this. I mean, this is a continuing tough summer for Governor Rauner. Now, he has a chance here that Republicans can walk away in a blue state, in the state of Illinois, with school choice, which is a very conservative Republican issue. And that could be a win for him to wrap up this summer. But as of right now, not a great look for the governor who got outmaneuvered and out-negotiated for the budget and saw some of his Republican colleagues, lawmakers in the House go against him. Could have happened again if they didn't get behind closed doors and negotiate, potentially. I mean, I guess just a tough, overall tough couple weeks, special
forgot
session.
About the Fox News interview.
And then the Fox News interview, which was on this new communications watch,
right,
where he became the ire of
national news.
What's her name?
And I was going to say, actually, Governor Rauner, now, there has been national news twice, right? Because the white male comment Illinois made the Washington Post, the New York Times, yeah, of Governor Rauner saying, as a white male, I don't think I should comment on this political cartoon.
Right. And the Fox News article where it was Ann Coulter who tweeted out, who is this guy? This guy's terrible. Essentially, he said much harsher words. But the idea that's who should be tweeting on your behalf. When you're an Illinois Republican governor in an interview, you shouldn't have Ann Coulter tweeting out against you in the interview. So not a great showing. But on the flip side, and you kind of mentioned,
is this going to matter? This is the important thing. Is this going to matter 9 months from now? Is this
going to
matter 10 months from now? I don't think it is. I think 10 months from now, perhaps Governor Rauner can say, if this all happens, he can say, I'm the governor who brought private school choice to Illinois.
Right. On its face, maybe, maybe not. But when you keep putting the Legos together, you're going to build something eventually. And he just has such a problem managing anything publicly. Either he won't say what's on his mind. He can drop the G's, but he can't speak, you know, plain
right.
English.
And I will say, you know, we mentioned the Trust Act also, mm-hmm, which was something that Governor Rauner had committed to immigrant groups that he was going to be signing. This is, again, the whole law enforcement sanctuary, mm-hmm, city sort of thing. And then on Fox News said, when he was being pressed to take a position on immigration and sanctuary cities and President Trump and was asked directly about that, said, it's under review.
Right.
And then when I followed up with his staff, they said, oh, it is under review. And I said, is he going to sign it? Is he not going to sign it? And then there was another week of, well, we're looking at it. Okay, yes, we are going to sign it.
Well, I just, I wonder,
so
though.
I go back to
your point, Nyla. I wonder if it is, I mean, if it's the right time, August, to be tripping up and having a tough summer. If the result is you come out with school choice, the result is that you block or modify what is considered a bailout for Chicago, and the result is that you were able to get the Democrats who are entrenched in Springfield to compromise. So, I mean, there is some – I mean, this is a long game, and Mike Madigan's really good at playing a long game. He's going to be the one who – I mean,
he's been there a long time.
Longer than my lifetime,
but
let's just all point out.
You know, for all the little punches that Governor Rauner's taking, you know, if he just has to concentrate on the long game, because that's what a campaign's going to be about.
Well, and to Nyla's point, if 2 years from now we do have a semi-operating state budget and a semi-operating school state school system,
yeah,
you know, is it going to come back to haunt him? Yeah, maybe. You know, there's a lot of money being put
Nyla Boodoo, Craig Newman in studio. We'll come back. We'll do overreported and underreported and also talk about what story will be remembered this week. Thanks, Rob. It is a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Nyla Boodoo, and Craig Newman in studio tonight. We're reloading this week's news. We're at the overreported, underreported part of our segment. Overreported, can I just name a couple things we don't need to talk about?
You just need to get it off your chest.
Hillary Clinton's creeped out by Trump in the debate.
Hard pass,
right? Taylor Swift's new album and that it's some sort of diss to Kanye West. Hard pass.
Unless she's talking about being creeped out by Trump, then that would be
with her newsprint cover.
She's got a brand new story. I won't spend a lot of time, but this whole song's about how it's a new Taylor. It's new Taylor.
The
old Taylor's dead. And then she's like, and I'm holding the grudge. And you're like, what? So this is a diss track? But you're a new person? Hollywood, you've run out of ideas. No, I'm not interested. Pass. And then the other one is the Trump meme, the eclipse meme, where Trump's head was in front of Obama and he tweeted out and then CNN actually did stories on it. I was like, he's a joke. It's a bit. I don't understand why we don't let this guy have a bit.
Aside from him, the idea of him tweeting memes from the Resolute Desk, which is kind of funny. But yeah, I mean, there are no slow news days. You don't have to write stories about
it. Yeah, I just feel like, where are we at? Then we're like, oh, who made this meme? And let's get him on the line. No, don't do that. People make memes all the time. But let's get to our overreported. Craig, you've got a controversial overreported story that I think will probably get pushed back in this room.
We're talking the eclipse here? Yeah, and it's controversial with me because I could talk about the eclipse like all day, every day. I'm kind of a space nerd, but come on, you know, nobody lost their eyesight. It was kind of a slow run up, and then all of a sudden you get to about Thursday last week.
You were in totality.
I was in totality,
and it wasn't emotional for you.
I did not pull a Skilling, but it was
which
pretty cool.
I am going to defend in this room and say, as someone who is a weather geek and not an actual weather person, I could understand his emotions.
Now, a Category 4 hurricane would be a Super Bowl for a weather person. What is a total eclipse of the sun?
I'm not sure. I would go with a. Because a hurricane is a sort of like a, it's like a marathon, negative. You know, I'm thinking of something that's really hard. And eclipses doesn't
have. It happens less often. It's like the Olympics.
Well, there's no natural.
I do agree. I've never seen a natural occurrence.
Phenomena
like this that was covered with such full every station, WGN as well. I mean,
oh, I did it. We all did.
Everyone did it live, and they had to be there for the moment. That in a lot of cases, even with TV, I mean, you can't really. I mean, you have to see it. I mean, it's not even a thing.
I think it was a little bit of a perfect storm, though. We're coming out of a weekend, which. I can't even remember what the news was last week.
Everybody wants something, and I think this was what I liked about the eclipse, was standing on the corner of Wacker and Michigan, and everybody was standing out on the street, and everybody was looking up, and I shared my glasses with a couple people, and it was like a nice moment where it was just no one was angry.
Well, I will
nobody
say
was screaming.
The moment was great.
Right.
The moment was great. I think when you're talking about the news and the coverage of it on every, circular.
So you're with
around
Shepard
it,
Smith.
Yeah, it was just a little too much. I agree. I think it was like, because when it was over, I felt, I was like, that was cool. And I was like, and then the minute I got back into any sort of Twitter or TV or anything, it's like, the eclipse, how was it? I'm like, nope. Done. So you, I saw it. It's done.
You more wanted partial coverage of the total eclipse.
That's right. But WGN did a great job.
I will say,
that goes without saying.
I think in terms of overreported, who went blind?
Yeah.
No one went blind.
It's unclear about the president yet. But yeah.
Right.
I will say, you know, I was down in the St. Louis area, I was staying with some relatives, and we were watching the news that night. And if you think it was overreported here, let me tell you something.
Yeah. Well, and shared.
That happened to be the same night that they were talking about this this guy that's on death row possibly getting taken off because of DNA evidence, and that was like a brief at the end of the newscast. It was all eclipse.
Thanks.
All right, let's talk underreported. You know, the one story that I think that we talked a lot about Afghanistan earlier, and that was something you had on your list. We also talked about the DACA stuff that was on your list, Nyla. The one that we haven't talked about is Mayor Rahm Emanuel and sanctuary cities, but also His ongoing fight with the Justice Department. Consent decree comes up. The Justice Department, this is a story about the Chicago police, and there was a federal probe. The Justice Department said they wanted a consent decree that essentially would give oversight, judicial oversight to the Chicago Police Department.
Which he was dragging his feet on from the get.
Right. And this is something that almost was like kind of pushed on us, but that was a thing that, you know, because of
in the
what
moment,
happened with Laquan
I think
McDonald.
With Laquan McDonald, yeah. What else could anyone do? Because there was so much pressure.
And then quietly, he's kind of been rolling it back. And now we're in a point where he doesn't want it. And the Justice Department, the political winds have changed. They don't want it. And so now a Black Lives Matter lawsuit has come to the city saying, no, you have to do this. You can't just pretend like it didn't happen. I think it's an underreported story. It goes part and parcel with the numbers of last weekend. The violence numbers that we saw were second to only the 4th of July.
Correct.
In terms of size. I mean, you get to the point now where, I mean, we're not even talking about violence. I mean, it went from desensitized numbers to sixth story behind everything else because, well, we don't want to talk about it. But it just seems to me that criminal justice and violence issues in Chicago are taking a backseat to a lot of other issues.
Well, I think the discussion is being led by a national push, but it's not in the right way. You know, I think a couple of years ago, we were all begging for national attention to, hey, look at us, help us figure out our problem.
And we're mad at the president for not coming and doing more,
at the president. Now, it's the only time we talk about Chicago violence is if the president tweets about it or Jeff Sessions goes down to Miami and gives a speech and says that a lot of our violence is being driven by immigration and illegal immigration issues. Without any data whatsoever to support that. And the mayor is kind of picking these fights, and I can't quite I know the sanctuary city fight, that makes some sense, or he doesn't like sanctuary city, what's his term for it?
Well, the lawsuit, though, and there was, to your point about underreported, and you're kind of in this theme of Rahm Emanuel versus the Department of Justice. Yeah. The Department of Justice did file on Thursday a response to this whole we can withhold funding for sanctuary, so-called sanctuary cities. Why don't we call it that,
Nyla,
right?
I mean, you just mentioned to me in the break, and I don't know enough about this issue, but, I mean, we're not talking about a ton of money.
It's not a huge amount of money.
Where you go, okay, well, this is really just political
It is money for law enforcement, right? It is money for law enforcement. When you look at the scope of the size of the budget of the police department for the city of Chicago, it's my understanding it's not a significant amount. No. It's not a huge amount.
But the question I would have going back towards the criminal justice and the consent decree is that the city of Chicago quietly has entered into negotiations with the Chicago Police Union.
Yes.
And they're doing that very quiet, hush hush. I mean, usually there's no bombastic yet. I'm sure there will be when things aren't going right. But this is, you know, the consent decree plays a part. I mean, we had the police union president in Kevin Graham sitting right here saying he felt that the Justice Department involvement in the first place was politicized by President Obama. But the police don't believe in the Justice Department consent decree. They probably are using that in their negotiations. The mayor knows that, so he is publicly pushing against it.
Well, and you have an administration that's very clearly saying, we do not think that this is a priority of the Justice Department. We do not think
they don't even believe
things
in consent decrees.
Exactly.
Right.
And it's not. Right. You know, so it's kind of an odd fight. The Sessions Justice Department doesn't want any part because it's a Law and Order Justice Department.
Well, and it's an Obama-era regulation of looking, using the Justice Department to look into the criminal justice system and talk about policing in a way that is completely the opposite of what President Trump wants to do.
Obama-era regulations are to this new administration.
Exactly.
It's a checklist.
Nyla Boodoo, Craig Newman in studio. We're reloading this week's news. We'll come back and we will do what stories took us down the rabbit hole and which stories will be remembered in 500 years from now. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Nyla Boodoo, the host of The 21st, which can be heard all over Illinois radio, Illinois public radio, all over the state, Monday through Friday. Craig Newman, longtime freelance journalist who used to be the managing editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, both in studio tonight, reloading this week's news. I mean, we have not even, I mean, it's amazing to me that all the news that happened just in the last 2 hours. And, you know, we didn't get to the executive order that was signed tonight on transgendered in the military, which, you know, that debate already happened when it was kind of thrown out there, but
or Governor Rauner's actions on transgender,
which Rob
people.
Just talked about. Yeah. I mean, that's one issue that we haven't talked about. The also tonight the hurricane, and that's your rabbit hole story, Nyla, because you have. I mean, you brought up it's 25 years since Hurricane Andrew.
Well, which is
that's crazy.
I mean, as a kid who was born and raised in Miami, I was a high school. That was my senior year of high school. I was my first news story I ever covered. That was. Changed South Florida forever. It changed the land, it changed the demographics, it changed people's lives. And I know firsthand, having lived through lots of hurricanes, how devastating they can be as someone who's lived through them and covered them. And so it is weird. I was actually just we were just talking about Hurricane Andrew a couple hours ago with a friend from Miami about our remembering how bad it was and what it was like. And looking, it's sort of weird to do that when I'm in a bar looking up at a screen of a hurricane image, and it's Harvey and it's Texas instead of Andrew in Florida, and everyone kind of forgets that was kind of the first. I mean, up until Katrina, Hurricane Andrew was the costliest natural disaster in American history prior to Katrina. So,
and it is. I mean, you grew up in Miami in a culture that had hurricane preparedness.
Well, the whole thing is I grew up in an era where there hadn't been a hurricane. It makes me nervous looking at Texas, because when you grow up in a culture where hurricanes are something that happened in the past and you don't take them seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, I started at the Miami Herald, and all week my Facebook feed has been full of all of those Miami Herald headlines, like, where the hell is the cavalry? Where President Bush, remember, elder President Bush, sending in, we need people to send people, we need help, we need water, we need all of these things. When communities are not prepared for hurricanes, it's really bad. And that's what worries me.
I mean, that's where we're at, Corpus Christi.
Right.
There was a hurricane, I forgot which one it was, the one hit Galveston not 5 years ago.
Right, I think there's Rita. Rita was the last major.
But the idea being that was at least a hurricane that came through this particular area.
It's tough, and you need a culture of it, right? It's like the equation for everybody that everyone here recognizes is everyone knows how to deal with the blizzard in the Chicago area, right? We know how to residents generally.
No, but I mean,
do.
You could make an argument. I mean, Mayor Daley, like, that he knew how to handle blizzards to the fact his dad as well, that they were the biggest ones in history. That's why they had a job. This was their job.
Right.
We're not talking about whose
lost control of Lakeshore Drive. We're just talking about people's own driveways,
Craig,
right?
What I thought was interesting, Nyla, is that, you know, there is always a political side to hurricanes and to natural disasters. How politicians react, how much funds emergency.
Right. Where's the FEMA for FEMA?
Right. Hurricane Katrina, of course, one of the most famous with George W. Bush. In this case, Donald Trump is first. You know, natural disaster on his watch, and he has jumped out in front of it and said, hey, you have the federal government, FEMA, everybody is on all of the bells and whistles, the regulations that you need, the hoops you have to jump through, they're gone. The money's there if you need it. I mean, not a bad statement for a president to make on your first go at this, right?
Well, that's true.
But saying you're unleashing...
unleashing is a weird word,
saying
right?
you're unleashing, like, you can't fight a hurricane.
Yeah.
You know, so... And we don't know what's going to happen. And unfortunately, a Category 4 is... I mean, I don't even want to think about how bad that's going to be. You know,
talking about it seems like the flooding is maybe...
Right. If you're talking about a 12-foot storm surge, 2 to 3 feet of water for a week. Again, this is like not like New Orleans where it's not a bowl. This isn't going to be stuck there. Things can drain, but there's going to be flooding. This is going to be a problem.
And the storm is just going to hang there for days.
Right. And the question is that creates unique challenges that the federal government is going to have to help with.
But
and
it is somewhat interesting, too, that Texas has two senators who have vociferously argued that the federal government should not get involved in disaster relief in the past, in the recent past. And now both Ted Cruz and John Cornyn are, they've reversed their stances on that, as they should.
I mean, does the government look at that? I mean, people who want to just shrink government, that's the state's job. That's what money's there. That's why they raise taxes. Is that the idea why you wouldn't want the federal government involved in natural disasters?
This was, Hurricane Sandy that hit New Jersey and the New York and the East Coast. Yeah, there was a lot of discussion about it then. It's an easy argument to make when you've got a base that wants a smaller federal government.
It's an easy argument to make to someone who's never been through a natural disaster, will say.
Right.
You know, tell that. I think people who have been through tornadoes throughout Illinois will have a different perspective on that than someone who has never lived through a natural disaster.
Now, I'm looking at Demetrius Ivory right now on the Weather Center on Channel 9, and he's – I mean, I guess these are – forecast numbers, but it says 35 inches.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So 35 inches is supposed to hit Houston in the next couple days.
Yeah.
Right.
That's insane. You know, we talk about when we talk about the Fox River and the Des Plaines River, we were only talking about 8 inches in 2 hours. Like it was a lot of water, but it wasn't 35 inches. Right?
Yeah.
Am I right on that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a ridiculous amount. And, you know, to get back to your point, when you first started talking about this, you know, these always get politicized, but if there's anything that we should be able to take the politics out of, it's, you know, the need for empathy around a natural disaster. You can ask questions after the fact. You can see if actions were appropriate. But, yeah, to the president's credit, it may not be artfully stated.
You're right. And you're right. I mean, the criticism around Hurricane Katrina was well after the fact about how people dealt with rescuing people and everything that happened after the storm, not necessarily what was happening.
It will be interesting to see if we learned.
Yeah.
And that's not something we will know until later.
Well, it's scary. And the whole country gets behind Texas as they go through this.
And by all accounts, the FEMA director is very well regarded and capable. We still have an acting DHS secretary, so it's, you know.
All right, let's go to your rabbit hole story. You've got one close to home here at WGN. Our possible new owner, Sinclair, who purchased the Tribune Media. There's been a lot of thought pieces on this, Craig, throughout the last couple months about what it means politically, but what it also means for local media. I like your take that it is just interesting about, you know, how big local media companies are getting.
Yeah, and the public comment on this closed, I think, on Wednesday or certainly midweek. Sinclair, for those who don't know, is a Maryland-based broadcast company. They own currently somewhere around 39% of local TV market stations. They would be able to expand somewhere near 72%. There's a lot of argument back and forth about Sinclair and their politics. That's not super relevant, although there are reasons to discuss that. But the idea that a media conglomerate can grow that big and blow past existing strictures from the FCC, which were about 39% of total markets ownership.
Well, that's how it happened, right? They changed the FCC changed the rules on it.
It is. And there's a lot of Congress people that don't have a lot of interest in getting involved in this discussion. A lot of them have received money from Sinclair or been lobbied by him. That's not necessarily new. But, we talk about fake news. We talk about knowing the source of your information. They're very quiet about how they broadcast things and who is putting forth ideas and who is putting forth news stories. It starts to become harder and harder to figure out where you're getting your information.
Yeah. Well, aside from the content part of it, the idea of a company right now, I mean, you go through public comment and then there are shareholder lawsuits and there are decisions that have to be made at the Justice Department about antitrust. Is that how big a company can get? I mean, it's amazing to me because
Trump's very unclear on his antitrust stance.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is, like, it's funny because it falls in the same category as the mergers that we see through the big telecommunication companies or the cable companies throughout the years, where it takes years for this stuff to happen. I mean, it's amazing to me that you could be like AOL and Time Warner are going to merge, and then you're going to be like, all right, when's that going to like this? Like,
years later.
I mean, it's just amazing to me the process it takes to merge media companies.
And as well it should. I think one of the more dangerous mergers we can look at in this day and age is how information companies are structured and how they're put together. There's a lot of money to be made on the local market. There's a huge marketplace there. It's a difficult conversation to have around local TV in particular, because that is such a personal atmosphere for a lot of people that live in the city. Although this will be Sinclair's first reach into major metropolitan areas, which makes it all more interesting.
To defend Sinclair in the conversation, I mean, they always get comments, but they say, hey, that's what we do. We do local news, and we do it well.
Their response when they came back this week is that they want to save local news. They see it as a decaying industry.
Well, it's an interesting story, of course, for me personally, but everybody else as well. All right, so let's get to our final category here before we wrap up. Which story from this week will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from now? Nyla, you want to take a first stab at what you think the story of this week will be?
I'm going to go with Hurricane Harvey just because it's such a big storm. And I think if we're going to remember this week, I'm going to say I think Harvey is going to have more significance than Afghanistan is my second. But if we're going to talk about national, that would be,
All right. Craig, what do you got for the story of the week?
I was going to go with white supremacists, but
sure.
Can we do something a little fun? Mm-hmm. Elon Musk came out with the design for SpaceX's spacesuits.
Love it.
And I was just watching a documentary about the Voyager spacecraft last night on WTTW. You know, we're talking about expanding into the solar system and beyond. We're talking about colonizing planets. I'm a huge space nerd. So just the idea that 500 years from now, we may be mining ice on a moon of Jupiter, and the idea that science fiction is actually becoming science.
And I would say also how cool we're going to look when we're doing it.
Well,
right.
I don't know about those
suits look pretty cool. it's not your father's spacesuit.
I plan on being around to use one. I don't know about you.
my story, though, remember, I'm a broken record, but this will be the week. I said it was going to be last week. This will be the week that Mitchell Trubisky outperforms Mike Glennon and becomes the starting quarterback for the Chicago Bears on opening day. And because of that, becomes the best quarterback Chicago's ever seen, Hall of Famer, best quarterback in the NFL.
Unless he's traded for Isaiah Thomas.
And then he gets traded for Isaiah Thomas. Right? Broken record. Craig Newman, Nyla Boodoo, I can't thank you guys enough for reloading this week's news. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock tonight, Preps Plus Chicago, the inaugural run for the 2017 high school football season. Sam Panionovich, Kevin Powell. How great is this? Can you believe it? High school football back? Tonight was the first round of games. They're playing as we speak, probably ending. When's a high school football? Pete, when's a high school football game end? Now, like 9:30? They got to end that. They can't be doing stuff after 10 o'clock, right? It's not like they can go to midnight. There's no 2 in the morning high school football games. Sam and Kevin will be in studio coming up at 10 o'clock, Preps Plus Chicago, here on 720 WGN. It's exciting. I got big dreams for my McHenry Warriors.
A lot of questions about the defense.
Questions. Yep. Whether they play tonight, I don't know. We'll figure that out. All right, before we do that, though, it is Friday night, so it's time for Reality Check, our weekly segment with Tracy Swartz, the ink columnist at the Chicago Tribune. She talks to us about the reality television storylines that revolve around Chicago. Tracy, how you doing? So I have a couple of big questions. I did a little bit of research today. One, let's first start with Married at First Sight. And what happened here? We lost a couple already. Like that was quick, right? They were supposed to be for a while, and you have breaking news on a divorce.
Right. So 3 weeks ago, we talked about the reunion show. We mentioned how it was a first for the franchise that all three of these Chicago couples decided that they were going to stay together at the end of the 8-week experiment. As you recall, this is people, strangers, meeting at the altar right. at the Palmer House and staying married. And so all three couples said at the end of the 8 weeks, they were going to stay together. Then at the reunion, we don't know when the reunion was filmed. They said that they were still together. And that reunion aired earlier this month. And now this week, one of the couples said that they are getting divorced.
They're out. Well, you know what? I don't want to say I saw it coming, but they did meet. They did meet and get married right away. Like I mean, that's the premise of the show. So I guess that is inevitable.
Right. I mean, most of the couples on this show, of the 15 couples, because this was the show's fifth season, 15 couples, only four are still together.
Wow.
And that includes the two couples from the most recent Chicago season.
Oh, wow. But the other two couples are still intact.
So far, I'm pretty optimistic that at least one of them will, you know, last for a very long time. The other one is kind of hit or miss for me. The couple that broke up was the one that we talked about. They never were physically intimate.
Right. Again,
details that I'm sure you wanted to know.
Again, I don't want to say that I knew what was going to happen, but yeah. All right, so let's talk about, before we get to the premiere coming up here of Love Blows, which is another great, great name for a reality let's talk about... I want to do Bachelor in Paradise too, but I saw today, and I felt like I almost knew what was happening. But I saw that the Bachelor, Nick,
yes.
Is breaking up with his lady, and that has nothing to do with Chicago. But that was the big news today.
Right. So it was actually, I was just thinking about this. It is not even a year since Nick was picked to be the Bachelor, and then he filmed his intro here in Chicago just like almost a year ago. So barely a year has passed between him finding out that he was the Bachelor, filming that entire series. The series airs, you know, he picks a woman and already broken up with her in a year.
Wow. Well, he's got to break up because he gets to get eligible again for another Bachelor, right? And that's the,
I don't think so. That was his fourth turn. He was on The Bachelorette twice, one season of Bachelor in Paradise, and then he was The Bachelor. And he's already done what most of them do, which is be on Dancing with the Stars after that.
Oh, I see.
Pretty soon I'm going to see him on Worst Cooks in America, which is where they go after Dancing with the Stars.
There's a format that these guys take. All right, good. All right, so Bachelor in Paradise still continuing. How are our Chicago guys, Digby and Bigby, doing?
Iggy and Diggy. Iggy had a terrible week. He was kicked off because he spent more time in Mexico making friends with his bros and palling around with them instead of trying to find a love
connection. So he's out?
He's out.
So he's kicked off. He's done.
He's done. And he was kicked off in the most horrible way, which was quietly. Essentially, the women gave out roses this week, and there were more men than women. So four men went home. And of the four men, they showed like three exit interviews, which is basically you stand in front of the camera and say, I can't believe this happened, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And they didn't show an Iggy exit interview. Instead, they showed one of the other guys fumbling with his seatbelt on the ride home.
Oh, Iggy. No respect for Iggy.
Well, no respect for Iggy, but it was a good week for Diggy.
Yeah, so Diggy's still in it.
Diggy actually went on two dates this week, one very uncomfortable horseback ride, and then he seemed to make a love connection with one of the women, but these love connections on this show are so fleeting. It's like...
This isn't The Bachelor. This is Bachelor in Paradise, right? This is a different kind of...
Right, so basically, well, they cut people off, and then they send more people in. So every time you think that there's a love connection, a new person comes in and, like, totally breaks it up.
Yeah. Sounds wonderful. I'm sorry I missed this week's episode. All right, so as we wrap here, let's talk about Love Blows. This is the premiere episode. You mentioned this one before, and then in the email today you said that. I was like, that's a dumb name. But I also, tell us about this one. This one has Chicago connections as well.
Okay, so it's on WeTV. It's actually premiering right now. It started at 9 o'clock. So for those people who are doing double duty, maybe they have Love Blows on mute while they're listening to you. This is a show about a family that of matchmakers and all the drama that comes with matchmaking. I saw the first episode. The title is pretty apt. It was very confusing to me because I was watching this episode and I was like, when did this episode film? Because they spent this entire episode talking about this one client that they wanted to land, and they were waving around Chicago Magazine. And the Chicago Magazine, you know how they do their annual singles issue. So they're like, we got to get this guy. He's like the number one bachelor in Chicago. And so I Googled this guy, and he was the number one bachelor in Chicago in 2012.
hey, that still could hold. You know, that's only 5 years ago.
I guess. I mean, something like being a bachelor seems like a fleeting title if you, you know, suddenly find yourself in a relationship. But, yeah, it actually filmed last summer here. And I did talk to the guy who was featured in the episode. The Chicago's most eligible bachelor of 2012 is still single, in case any of the ladies want to know. And, this is a 6-episode series, and it airs Friday nights on WeTV, which I'm sure is your favorite channel.
Yeah, it's top two, maybe three, maybe three. All right, Tracy Swartz, she is the ink columnist for Chicago Tribune, joins us every Friday night with Reality Check. Tonight, giving us an update on Bachelor in Paradise. I feel like we need to play like a slow song out to give remembrance to Iggy.
Was Diggy, it Iggy? Yes.
Iggy, yes, for losing. But Diggy, he's still around. And, of course, the premiere tonight of Love Blows, the matchmaking show that's set in Chicago. Tracy, we're off next week, so we'll catch up with you after Labor Day. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
There he is, Sam Panionovich, Kevin Powell, coming in the building. They are sitting down right now for the first Preps Plus Chicago, which, of course, starts tonight. High school football in the building.
Do play-by-play. What am I doing now?
Sam, he's got his arms up. He's making some muscles.
We're excited.
Justin, do you have a countdown clock in the off-season to when Preps Plus starts?
I do.
Like August 25th, you know Preps
me.
Plus.
You know me. Chicago's I wish I could just do every hour.
Best part about Preps Plus is it's still nice out. It's still technically summertime. Happy hour has been going on for about 5 hours now. So by the end of our show at 11 o'clock, the people that walk by have no shame.
None.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
It's a Friday night. Okay, guys, so this is a big deal. I mean, the high school football season here in the state of Illinois starts tonight. I mean, let's start. Just set the scene because I haven't paid attention to the off seasons of high school football programs.
Neither have we.
Yeah. Well, Sam can set the scene for the entire state, but I'm just looking forward. Really, there was a lot of good games, but you know how Alabama's playing Florida State,
right?
And I equated it to this earlier. Next week to kick off the college football season. Tomorrow it's Glenbard West against Maine South, which have been two powerhouses. Glenbard West, correct me if I'm wrong, Sammy, they've been to the semifinal 7 of the last 9 years. They're a powerhouse. Maine South has
They won the title last year.
They upset Loyola in the state championship.
And they're regionally close to each other.
Fairly close. I mean, both Northwest, West Burbs-ish. That they play tomorrow afternoon. That's how you kick off a high school football season.
That's number one, Glenbard West. Number two, Maine South, tomorrow at 1:30.
Wow.
Here's a list of the other games. Loyola Phillips, Loyola private powerhouse Phillips, Southside Chicago.
Right. They won the state title, the Phillips did, right?
Yeah, the first public league team to do so. They did that last year. Prairie Ridge, Cary Grove, huge in the Northwest Burbs. Lamont, Batavia, Crete Moni, Lincoln Way East. You got Brother Rice and Marist on the south side. That's neck and neck right now.
Yes.
Naperville Central, Glenbard North, Lake Zurich, Fremd, Stevenson, Palatine, and then Oak Park at Simeon, another private or another public against Chicago Public League.
Let me ask you, is it the same when it comes to college, the idea that you play some out-of-division games at the beginning of the season, or they go right into the divisional
The high school football insiders would call it non-con games.
Yeah.
They're actually more intriguing to me in high school football because they don't really shy away from playing other powerhouse schools in the early going. Like, in college football, once in a while you get like a really good interconference battle like we have with Alabama and Florida State. But you don't see that a lot because teams are afraid you lose and your season's over, essentially. But these schools, they always have that first week, which is like, it's up to them and it's up to schools. So coaches are friends. It's like, how cool is it that Glenbar West and Main South aren't shying away from the fact that they're powerhouses? Two coaches call each other, and this is set ahead of time. And, you know, they call each other and say, look, this would be an awesome matchup. Let's do it. So I think in high school, teams are a little less afraid to go ahead and pair themselves against a tough team in the first week, where like in college football, you know, some teams are like, well, I don't want to mess around with that.
Let me ask you guys, I'm fascinated. Does it work in college when obviously high school is different because you're just pulling from the kids that live or go to the school. It's not a lot of recruiting that goes in, although there probably is. But I mean, when you're talking about going from a sophomore to a junior, I mean, do you see turnover where a team like last year wins the 7A championship and then this year go 3-9 because the kids are different? Or is it pretty steady when it comes to a program that, you know, it's about how they play and how they coach and everything, that they're always winners?
The top 10 teams usually, and you probably agree, they usually recycle pretty well. Your Loyolas, your Barringtons, your, Phillips has been really good as of late, Prairie Ridge, the Lincoln Way schools have always done this.
The Catholic Blue Schools,
yeah,
which
Saint
is the
Rita,
powerhouse
Mount Carmel,
school.
Brother Rice, right. Even Marist are not in the Catholic League, but those teams always recycle pretty well. But you do see some turnover. In fact, we're going to talk to Chad Hetlett. He's the coach of Glenbard West. They're number one in the Tribune papers. And in that division, the West Suburban Silver, they've been the cream of the crop. They won 5 division titles in a row. Last year, they lost to Hinsdale Central, and now they're on the rise. You've got Oak Park on the rise. Lions came out of nowhere last year in LaGrange. So that's like a 4-horse race right now in the West Suburban. So there's always people that kind of chomp at the bit on the lower levels of the divisions, but usually the powerhouses are always pretty healthy year in and year out.
Yeah, because it's high school sports, so you know, there are, like Sam said, 10 to 20 schools that are always going to be competitive. But there's also the one year where a team that you always sort of see on the losing side and their quarterback, like
Hersey.
No, seriously, that's a perfect example. Okay, so I went to Hersey, Husky Pride. They're going to win tonight. Huge, nice opening week victory.
They're up 42.
Coach Pardon, I see you. I see you. I'll text you later.
What's the score?
41-0 on Zion Benton. Goldsberry's
on
my
their
boy.
Head.
He's their quarterback.
On their head.
But it's high school sports, right? So, like, you could have a team that's up and down. Like, they'll be good. They'll make the playoffs, and they drop off for a couple of years. Because you have, you know, some kid out of nowhere who, like, goes through puberty before everybody else, and then they get recruited by a D1 school, and they just say, give this kid the ball, let him run past everyone. So, like, you see that here and there. I mean, it's high school stories. But for the most part, and you'll hear in the interview Sam had with the Glenbar West coach, like, they know, those guys know how to build programs and the consistency.
We'll hear all about high school football when it comes to states like Florida or Texas, down in the South.
Even the Triangle, like the D.C. area,
yeah,
Maryland.
DC, yeah. Where does Illinois rank when it comes to their football and the culture around high school football?
Well, it's funny you ask that. Mike Helfgott, who's our prep expert, he'll join us after 10:30. He said that this is one of the least talented years Illinois has had in the last handful of years. Now, Illinois, you think, you know, basketball is usually full of talent, a plethora of talent, you know, top 5 in the country as far as states go. In football, usually top 3rd. But there are not really that many national recruits this year. There's a couple guys going to Iowa. There's a receiver going to ND, Notre Dame. But the talent level, you know, compared to the last couple of years since I've been doing the show, is not where it has been. But it's still, you know, still top 3rd of the 50 states. My favorite high school athlete, though, is the big offensive lineman that grew up on a farm in Batavia. You know, he's been milking cows since he was 4 years old, and now he's 6'7", 300 pounds, playing left tackle. Those are the guys we do this for. We do it for you, the milkers and the cow guys and all that. So
my last question before we hand it over to you guys and take a break and then get you in here. Where's McHenry? McHenry, the Warriors? That's
right.
I thought you were going to ask
about Antioch. No, that was last year.
That was last year.
You picked the school last year. And you
I did.
Like,
I picked Antioch. And they started off okay, and then they dropped off. But I'm all about the McHenry Warriors. That's
all right, McHenry beat Crystal Lake South 50-13.
You see how quick he is?
Whose house?
You see how quick that was?
McHenry West's house.
He just made that up. That was too fast.
I will say the first thing that popped up when I typed the McHenry into the Twitter search bar was Britt McHenry, so I had to sort through. Yeah. That's some high quality reporting by me there. Yeah, that's a big 50-13 win over Crystal Lake.
We don't. And the McHenry guys are not big into the Crystal Lake teams, so that's a good rivalry.
Did you grow up in McHenry?
I did, in Wonder Lake.
Oh, Wonder Lake, but you went to McHenry.
Yeah, we went to McHenry. At the time, they had some really Coach Knox. They had Coach Knoll. I can't remember which
one. You know what else we need? We need to hurry up. We got to find the Glenbrook South score. Martyr's going to kill us.
I love how, I was just guilty of it. Like, when people talk about their high school, people just start reminiscing out loud. Coach Cox. Yeah, he was such a good guy.
I don't even remember the coach's name.
People start reminiscing. Wasn't Crystal Lake South the one that got in trouble for building the stands?
I was stuffed in lockers in high school, so I don't know anything about any of this.
All right, well, Preps Plus Chicago is coming up here right after the break, guys. Looking forward to it. All right, that's going to do it tonight for The Download. We are off next week. We got our vacations, so we will be Mubala's in, Noonan's in, Amy Goose in. There's a lot of people coming in. I'm very excited to have such great talent that's going to be in next week. We'll be back right after Labor Day. Preps Plus Chicago coming up next. Good news, Rob. Glenbrook North is where you went?
South. Do not do this.
It's a good thing you're going on vacation.
Oh, those are fighting
honest
words.
South, the Titans.
Final score again?
What do you got?
Hang on, give me a second here, Rob.
He just had it.
Glenbrook South over Urban Prep, 42-0. Pitching a shutout in week one.
Oh, there you go.
Just like it was when I was there, baby. Under Coach Bob.
Coach Bob. All right. There you go. All right. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. 10:02, here is the pride of Glenbrook South.